Hey, welcome to the podcast. This is the Upland Nation. You are one of the many citizens, and I sure appreciate your listening. Great show in store for you today. My name's Scott Linden. I'm the host. I'm also the host of the television series Wing Shooting USA. I hope you'll watch that as well. Phil Borgeli, you recognize the name. We'll find out what's new with Phil, good friend of mine and an expert in shooting, hunting, and all the related areas. Phil Borgeli will be joining me in just a moment. We'll also have a public access tip, some hunting strategy and dog handling advice, a quiz and a prize. Somebody out there is going to win something really nice, so stick around for all of that here on the Upland Nation. And by the way, if you haven't gotten it that way yet, uplandnation.com is where you go for all of this. You go to sageandbreaker.com if you want to talk about gun cleaning and gun care. They're our newest sponsor, Sage and Breaker, owned by Fred Bohm and his family, doing a great job of high-quality gun cleaning products and accessories. I love their stuff. It is the kind of stuff you can hand down to your heirs and their heirs afterwards, all wrapped up and nice looking as well as great performing. I was at a NAVDA training day over the weekend out in the middle of the desert. Yeah, you can imagine how dirty it got. I used the Sage and Breaker CLP Clean Lube Protect formula, anti-static, all that dust and stuff that's floating around out there. Well, most of it stayed off the metal parts on my shotgun. I did get a chance to shoot for a little while, and it worked better than I thought it would. I mean, my shooting. I knew the CLP would work well. Free shipping on everything. CLP is made in the USA. Sageandbreaker.com is where you get more information, some informative videos, and all sorts of great products. Speaking of sorts of great, on the line with me from somewhere in Iowa, Phil Borgeli, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
Same here. It seems like these days all we do is cross like ships in the night at the SHOT Show, but I still remember fine.
You're tall and you wear that hat because that's the way I spot you in the crowd.
Well, that's better than nothing, I guess, unless you're taking aim. I still fondly remember. In fact, I just came across one of the Telly Awards we won for that television show that I produced and you were on, Clay Target Shootout.
Yes, and I appreciate the chance to, I've done TV since and getting a chance to learn from you on the job and from Lisa Densmore and from the crew really helped me a lot when it came time to do the Gun Nut TV show and some of the things I've done since then.
Oh, I believe it, and I still love to rub it in once in a while. I gave him his start in television, for what it's worth. So you've got lots of other things on your docket these days, including the most recent adventure, about 11 weeks old. Tell me about your new dog.
Zeke is a German short hair. I just put him down for a nap in his box, so I think we're going to be able to talk for half an hour. He came from Top Gun Kennels in Central City, Iowa. It was time. My older dog, I have another short hair. He's 11 years old, still pretty spry, and I think I'll have another year or two with him, but it was past time to start another one. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting up at 3 in the morning. Only have to get up at once at night, which is good. He's doing very well. He's a great little dog so far, but he's still an 11-week-old puppy, and it's like having a toddler in the house again. And since my kids are now 30 and 25, it's been a long time since I had a toddler in the house.
Wow. And I hate to admit this, but it's so fun to think of those two guys and my two favorite Eagle Scouts, your kids. Good job, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Actually, my younger son is in basic training even now. He's joining the Colorado National Guard, so he's in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, fighting bugs and humidity and floodwaters and I don't know what else, because we don't hear from him. We're not allowed to talk to him, but that's where he is.
Still serving as an adult, and we appreciate that. Most people will know you for your writing in Field & Stream magazine, and I'd love to talk with you about that. first, because you are exposed to so many different things, and you probably have a million questions from other people. But what are you trying to accomplish with your writing in Field and Stream?
My goal, I guess, is that we assume that our audience is hunters rather than target shooters, and our goal is to get them on target quickly. You know, to tell them what they need to know to hit more birds cleanly in the fall. We've started to expand that a little bit. I got to do a column about the conservation challenges facing rough grouse currently, and some others, a few short essays. But mostly, you know, the core mission of the column is to help people shoot more birds.
Well, help me shoot more birds. You know a little bit about my problems. I'm left eye dominant, colorblind, and curved spine, among other things. But, you know, if you were to just in general kind of boil everything down, what is the most common problem and what is your suggestion or solution for that shooting slash hunting related shooting problem?
The most common problem, it's a little bit frustrating for me because I can write all this stuff, all this advice, and people can read it. But if you don't put the magazine down and pick up a shotgun in the summertime and go shoot clay targets, it doesn't really matter what I write or what you read. That'd be the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
I shoot clay targets. I love shooting clay targets, but I do it purely as hunting practice. I shoot a little bit of registered sporting clays, not very much, and I enjoy that. But the reason I shoot targets is so that I can shoot birds.
All right, so if you had the choice, Phil, and you had one target clay target game to shoot if you wanted to be a better bird hunter, which one would it be?
Sporting clays is, you know, it's got the most variety. I think it even though there are shots there that are not like anything you see in the field. My belief is that if you can hit those, you can hit anything. I also, before there was access to sporting clays around here, I shot a lot of skeet, which I think low gun skeet is also extremely good.
Sure.
Practice.
Invented by grouse hunters, you know?
It was invented by, it's funny, it's invented by grouse hunters, but it's really, I think, a better game for dove hunters and duck hunters because there's so many crossing shots. If your main goal is to shoot going away birds, then trap is a really good game for that, even though it takes, you know, different guns and they're shot pre-mounted usually. But anything that gets you out and handling your gun and practicing the right things is good.
Speaking of good, we're both passionate bird hunters. I have my reasons, you have yours, and now you get to share those reasons with us. Why do you go bird hunting, Phil?
I was a locavore before it was cool to be one. I'm going to start with that. That's why I hunt. I tell people I hunt because I'm bad at gardening. But it's a way that I can, shoot my own food. And that is important to me. From a health standpoint, from a taste standpoint, from an animal welfare standpoint, all these things, the more I can shoot my own food, the better. And so, especially since it's now just me and my wife at home, it takes most of the year to get through what we've got in the freezer. Especially since I discovered hunting Canada geese and they're big, we should have it done by the time dove season rolls around. But that's the first. As why upland hunting, part of it is I grew up in Iowa back when we had lots and lots of pheasants. I didn't start shooting and hunting until I was right at the end of college, but once I started, I didn't really want to do anything else, and there was a lot of pheasants, and my dad was a bird hunter, and I liked to walk, and I liked the dogs, and I really come to like bird guns, too, and so that will always be probably my first love is hunting pheasants and quail. Canada geese are getting to be right up there in duck hunting. And then we've got a dove season in Iowa. And I grew up in a state where doves were protected songbirds, and it's only been the last 8 or 9 years we've been able to dove hunt, and I do a lot of that and really enjoy it. But I guess if I had to pick one, it would be upland hunting because of the dogs, because I like to walk. I think about, they're all great when they're good. I think there's nothing very much more exciting than, say, turkey hunting when it's good, or goose hunting when the birds are working right. But on the days when it's bad, at the end of a bird hunt, at least you've had a good walk. So I look at it that way.
I love that, and it's so
true.
You
walk yourself, you walk the dog, and the other thing is I never get tired of walking after dogs. I have very little attention span for deer hunting, which is why I don't do much of it anymore. But I can stare at the sky and wait for ducks for a long time, and I can follow dogs for even longer than that. And I really believe when I'm hunting that every step I take, even if it's been a long day with no birds, every step I take is the one that's getting me closer to the next bird.
Amen to that.
It doesn't always work that way, but I believe that.
Well, now you're getting literary, and I'm going to talk about that for a moment. By the way, that is Phil Borgeli. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm your humble host, Scott Linden. And Phil and I go way back, and one of the things that really shocked me, speaking of literary, is your literary heritage. I bought a used book somewhere years ago and was just reading along, get to the back page, turn it over. There's a picture of your father with a cornet or a trumpet in the shot. Who was the author of that book?
It was my dad.
Yeah.
His father was a newspaper man and his mother was a storyteller and wrote children's books. So it's a family blessing or curse, whichever, it's not a, there's other professions where you make more money than this one, but it is what we do. And honestly, both my kids, especially my older son, is probably a better writer than I am. And both of them also saw the life of a freelance writer up close and decided they wanted something more. So
smart kids.
My older son's an attorney. He does write. He writes short stories and poetry on the side. He's very special in poetry. He's very, very good. My younger son's a good writer too. But it does run in the family. There's not a lot of things I can do, but writing is one, and it seems to be hereditary.
I love it. It's like the music world. When I was in that, I told everybody it was a great thing to do in your spare time. Don't expect to make a living at it.
Some of the best advice I ever got was don't quit your day job, which I didn't take that advice. And for me, it worked out, but I was lucky. I worked hard at it. Fortunate to, one of the things that helped me a lot when I started with Field & Stream, one of the Slate & White, one of the editors there, took me under his wing as his project, and he said, we don't have many people in the Midwest, so don't move to Montana like all those other writers, and we'll have work for you.
Yeah, it was pretty easy. You didn't have to do anything to pull that off. But he's absolutely right. The rest of us are somewhere over here. You shoot a lot. You shoot a lot of guns. A lot of people look at your opinions of guns as, worth taking stock. Pardon the pun. Taking stock of when they're shopping for one. If we were going to look for a new hunting shotgun, the first question is actually from one of our listeners, Randy Fusey, who asks, "Are there any good moderately priced side by sides out there?"
There are. The fact it was reintroduced this year, CZ has a gun they call the Bob White, which actually is like the Bob White 2 or the Bob White something. But they redid a gun. They used to sell a ton of when we had a lot of pheasants around here. And it's back. It's a very inexpensive gun. It's, $600 or $700 double gun. Turkish made, straight grip, double triggers, all the classic bird gun features, and that's a good one. Then another company, Dickinson Arms, makes, again, the Turkish guns. They're the guns that were the Kimber shotguns and some others, Smith & Wesson shotguns for a while. they're good guns, and they are a little pricier and a little better looking, and they have a gun, plantation grade, I think, Dickinson Plantation, a few different ones, Dickinson, I'm sorry, I think I said Dickinson, I meant to say Dickinson, those guns are nice, and those are in the, like, $1,500 range, which, you know, I never know anymore what affordable means.
Right.
But I think that's affordable for a lot of people. Certainly the other gun is. Mm-hmm. And then there's used guns. I get all my guns used.
So if you're shopping for a used gun, is there any telltales that we ought to be mindful of that will either clue us in or clue us out to that particular purchase?
Sure. A couple things. The classic advice when you buy a double gun is buy the barrels, which means that having barrels fixed is expensive. So if your gun is, if the barrels are pitted, if there's a bulge in them, that's a definite stay away. If they're pitted, it's going to cost you a lot of money to have them polished out, and they'll just keep rusting if you don't. So, yeah, buy the gun, and if they've been cut down, say, or something like that, you don't want them. So that's the first thing. The second, I usually look at how tight the action is. Not that putting guns back on face or tightening the action is an expensive job. Actually, it isn't. But I usually make sure that the gun is tight. You know, just take the fore end off, take the barrels in one hand and the stock in the other, and just give it a wiggle. And if it rattles, then it's, you know, you have to have it tightened up. You can also look at the top lever. You know, as long as that is not down at 6 o'clock, but is over 6 o'clock, is fine. 5 o'clock is better. When it gets over there past 6 o'clock, if you're looking at it, gets over to the left, then that means the gun has worn quite a bit. Those are the first things I look at usually. When I look at a used gun, I say look at the barrels, because that's going to that may very well run into money if you need to have something fixed, and obviously the gun has to be in shootable condition. You want to buy it from someone who will let you bring it back if there's a problem with it. But those are the first things I look at.
All good advice. That's Phil Borgeli, most notable as the Field and Stream writer on all things shotguns and, I guess shotgunning, I'll call it. Stick around, everybody. This is the Upland Nation podcast. Phil will be back in a moment with us. In the meanwhile, let's take a quick break here and talk about our other big sponsor, Dakota 283 Kennels. Now, you know these guys, they were making the heavy-duty dog crates and kennels before everybody else was, and I'll tell you, they're doing a great job of it, and they've got a special offer for you and me and anybody else who's listening. If you buy one of their G3 kennels, free with the purchase is either a forever insert for your young dog like Phil has, perhaps, or a free dine and dash water storage and food storage container that I use virtually daily when I'm driving with my dogs. For either of those, when you get to the checkout, just type in the coupon code, if you will, Linden FI or Linden DD. Now, what I like about these Dakota 283s is the fact that before anybody else had glommed onto the idea, these guys were using military design and resin technology. The nice thing is they are hard to break, and they are great in cold and hot environments. Now, if you're putting that dog in there, as you should every time you travel, the molded-in handle means you don't have to worry about a failing D-ring that's holding your tie-downs. It goes right through and straps over. I was just taking mine out yesterday, and I appreciated that, not because it didn't fail, but because it will never fail. All at Dakota283.com. Dakota 283 Kennels. Remember, free shipping on every purchase. You get that free forever insert or dine and dash free. They're both at Dakota 283 Kennels. All right. So, Phil, speaking of kennels, how's your pup doing over there?
He's doing great. He's still asleep. We're still in nap time, so I'm good to talk for a while.
Okay. Just don't yell.
He's been doing really well. He's only have to get up once at night. I've I've been getting up about 3 or 3:30, and I wake him up, which sometimes I feel like I should probably let him sleep. But this way we haven't had any accidents in the box in 3 weeks. So that's going very well. And we're doing just basic obedience. I feed him 4 times a day, and before that, when I've got his attention, we do, sit, stay, started putting him on the check cord, letting him run around the yard a little bit. So he's doing really well.
He's
a smart little dog.
It's appropriate as we're talking, the music behind us, hopefully someday I'll remember to do it right, is the background for our Handle It feature on dogs and handling dogs, if you were, and you're right on target there. One of the things that I learned a long while ago, and maybe you did too, is those young dogs, when you're waking them up in the middle of the night or they're waking up themselves, if you want them to go back to sleep, because it is only 3:30 and most of us don't have to get up regularly at that hour, is to leave the lights off. Take them outside, but try and keep it dark the whole time. Anything else along those lines, puppy raising tips for us, since you're basically living the dream or the nightmare, Phil?
It alternates between dream and nightmare. He's been great. I have not done that because I don't want to fall down the stairs, but he's been great. He goes back to sleep, and like this morning, I got up at 6:30, I woke him up, which I did not expect. Nice that I have the older dog who's also always been very, very chill in his box. So the two of them, I think it helps to have the two of them together. But, he's been great that way. We'll start kindergarten. He'll get his 12-week-old puppy shots Monday, and then I'll get him enrolled into kindergarten class, which I did with Jed, my 11-year-old dog. And that, even though all the stuff you do in those classes is stuff we would do anyway, I think it's really valuable for the dog to get out and see other people and other dogs, and it helps them socialize. And besides, which I remember with Jed, I was talking about it being like having a toddler, I would look forward to Sunday night's dog kindergarten all week because I knew we had something to do, and I knew he would sleep when we got home.
It's so true. Yeah.
But that I think, I don't know, I think it's a very, very valuable start. And I think that really, and I had never treat trained with dogs before. I think that really, really, just, he's a very agreeable, very biddable dog. I think the puppy will be too. And I think that early kindergarten experience was money extremely well spent, even though I say it's all stuff that you and I know how to do at home. I think getting him out in that classroom environment into the wider world a little bit is very useful.
There's no doubt about it. I mentioned earlier that I was at a NAVDA test over the weekend, and the weekend before that at a NAVDA training event. And half the reason I bring my dog, even if we're not involved in the test, is still at almost 2 years old. The whole idea of socializing with other dogs and other people and all the commotion that takes place, whether it's there or the shopping mall, it's all good for a dog. You want that dog, of course, steady, not just steady
right
on point, but steady emotionally for all of those reasons.
I prefer friendly dog. I like dogs. I'm not so much for the one mm-hmm. person dog. I like dogs that are nice to everybody and want to get to, maybe people who come to my house don't want that, but I like a dog that's ready to be everybody's friend. And I think that you get that socialization too, that advantage of taking them out early and getting them introduced to other people and other dogs and having them know that it's a fun, exciting situation.
Fun and exciting. You're absolutely right, in the right doses. Hey, let's switch gears for a minute because people look up to you as a guy who's been around and done that and got the T-shirt over and over again. Out in the field, you're hunting pheasants, you're hunting quail, and you're lucky enough to hunt all sorts of other things as well. if you were to look at a field and say you had any choices you could possibly have for how to approach that field with a pointing dog, for example, you got any strategic advice for us on starting out there in that field on that day? What would you look for?
Direction of the wind is the main thing. It's funny you ask that. I think about the fields I hunt a lot. Birds are always in the same places, even though it may look different or they're all the same to you and me. For there's something about fields, and I'm thinking here mostly of like big set-aside fields. You hunt them over and over, and you find the birds in the same place every time. And that, you know, that just takes time to learn where that is. But yeah, I will look at the wind, and if possible, I'll want the dogs facing into the wind. And it always, you know, living out here in the Midwest, I'll hunt with a lot of people. I will go ahead and stereotype lab people. They want to just line up and march wherever they go, you know, wherever they want to go, regardless of which way the wind is blowing. And that that kind of hunting, I don't think is as efficient, because you get birds that know you're coming, and the dogs don't know they're there. You know, if you think about it, it's like for them, it's like walking with a blindfold on. They've got the wind at their back. And so yeah, I'll do that. And I was really struck a couple years ago. I had a chance to hunt in Uruguay. We hunted Perdiz, which is their upland bird down there, and they had some really good setters. But the outfitter we were in there, the Perdiz is a little bird that lives in very short, like, pastures, really. So you see them on the ground a lot, and they're very skittish, and they run a lot. And in order to make sure we only hunted into the wind, they would actually take a vehicle down and leave. You know, we'd walk a few hundred yards, and then we would get in the truck, and we'd drive back upwind, and we'd do it again. Upwind, downwind, I can never remember. Anyway, so we were always in the wind, because those birds especially, since they can see the dogs coming, if the dogs can't, you have the advantage of getting that scent at long range because it's being blown to them. You know, they're gone. So that was an extreme example. I mean, we never hunted with the wind at our backs on that hunt, and it worked out very well. But yeah, that's the main thing. I want to make sure that when I get to the parts of the field that I think are going to be the good parts, that I've got the wind blowing in my dog's face.
Mm-hmm. I had a sharp-tailed guide a couple seasons ago in Montana say he does a big circle, and if you think about it, three-quarters of the time you're going to get scent that is going to cross your dog when he's patterning in front of you. Uh-huh. When you do a circle like that. And then when you're done, you're back at your truck again.
Right.
None of that commuting as you were doing there. You know, tell me a little bit about some of that foreign hunting you've done, because that Perdiz hunt I've turned down twice, and I regret it both times. Have you been any other cool places that we ought to at least add to the bottom of our bucket list?
You know, for upland birds, except for sharptails in Canada, that's been it. You know, all the other upland hunting has been in North America. Yeah, the Perdiz hunting, you really do wish you could somehow take your own dog down there, because it's just so much fun. We had very good dogs that we hunted over. And really, it's hard to imagine. It is the easiest walk. I like to see the dogs, so the fact that the cover is like a few inches high is great. The walking is extremely easy because it's a cow pasture. It's a real, you know, it's a pretty easy hunt. It's a lot of fun. And the birds are great. They're sporty. They're like miniature pheasants. You'll shoot half of them maybe over points, and the other half you're shooting as they flush wild. They're a sporty bird. They're a tasty bird. Usually you can shoot about 10 times I've been down there. But that is one that I would certainly like to have a chance to do again. I've done it a couple times, and three times, I guess, and certainly where I can take the dove shooting or leave it alone down there. The Perdiz and the waterfowl hunting is really fun, especially the Perdiz. It's just because that's the closest thing, you know, to the kind of hunting we do here, only it's a different bird and a whole different experience.
Well, most people who look at South America look at those other two that you just alluded to, and that's the reason I turned down that trip twice. They wanted me to come down and make duck hunting shows or dove hunting shows, and I wanted to make upland shows only.
Right.
Did you experience those other two? Did you shoot some doves and ducks while you were on that trip?
I have. I've been three times, I guess, to South America, and I have done mixed bag hunts each time, which means we shoot ducks in the morning and then either doves or pigeons or birdies in the afternoon. I really enjoy the birdies. The dove hunting, honestly, I like dove hunting at home.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the do-it-yourself aspect of it is fun. We scout hard for our doves, and a good hunt here in the cornfield, even though we shoot 15 instead of 1,500, is to me really fun and rewarding. Down there, I really enjoyed the perdiz hunt. I really enjoyed the pigeons, which are pass shot or shot over decoys and are among the toughest birds I've ever shot. They can take a lot of shooting. They're very sporty, big birds, and I would certainly like to do that again.
Not the same pigeon as here.
Duck hunting is, pardon?
Not the same pigeon as here, but very close resemblance.
It's a spot-wing pigeon.
It's
a different bird. It's a tasty bird. We've eaten them down there. Can't bring them back, but we have eaten pigeons down there. And they do decoy quite well,
mm-hmm.
which also makes it fun. The duck hunting, honestly, a lot of that is done over bait,
mm-hmm.
which you just have to tell yourself, I'm thousands of miles from home. This is how they do it here.
Mm-hmm.
And you go ahead and do it. And I like it because of the variety of duck species and the variety of birds that you see when you're hunting out there. That's really enjoyable to me. It's a good trip.
Cool.
I'm very lucky to have been down there a few times.
Neat. That's good to hear. I might take somebody up if they care to offer me one more time. Hey, here's,
I think you should.
Yes, I'll do my best, I promise. Which, by the way, reminds me, for the first time on Wing Shooting USA this season, which is now underway, you will see me actually shoot at a duck. So watch closely. It goes by pretty fast, but I actually did kill it. Hey, we got another question from a listener here. Brian Lee Wynn has a 11-year-old son. They shoot a lot of clay targets. The challenge is he's getting a bruise on the cheek along his jawline. Now, Phil, you're the guy. Is that gun fit? Is that an overly aggressive load? What can you do to help this 11-year-old so he stays fired up about shooting, but avoid that bruising on his face?
I started both my boys about that age. A lot of people like to start their kids younger. I didn't. And I bought a Remington 1100 youth gun, which is heavier than a lot of 20 gauges.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it soaks up recoil, and being a gas gun, is very soft shooting. And I don't know what kind of gun Brian's son shoots, but a lot of people buy their kids light 20 gauges of those. Those youth pump guns, because mm-hmm. they figure, well, the 20 gauge is light. That's what a young person needs. And those guns really bite.
Yeah.
When you shoot one of those yourself, it's got quite a rap to it. And that, I would suspect, sight unseen, that just because I've seen that so many times. I've coached scholastic clay target program kids for quite a while, and a lot of times you'll see kids, they'll show up with their first gun, which is one of those youth pumps, and it beats them around pretty hard. So that, and there are some good choices in low recoil ammunition. You have to pay a little more for them, but the Winchester Feathers are great. The Fiocchi and Cleaver 3/4 ounce loads are great. If you reload, you can make whatever you want, obviously, for new shooters. And, yeah, it's important to keep it fun for kids. There's people who... Some people will put up with a lot of pain to shoot, and some people will find something else to do. And you want to make sure that's not a barrier that you're putting up. Or I talked to a woman once who told me she worked for a gun maker, and she said she took up sporting clays. She's small, And when she'd get to the gun club, she'd have a gun of her own. So she'd get to the club and she'd use one of their loaner guns. And the only way she could make it fit was to take the recoil pad off and just shoot with the wooden, flat wooden butt against her chest, which didn't fit at all. And she said she would drive home pretty much bleeding and thinking about when could she go again. And that's one person in a thousand. Most of us, if we go do something that makes us bleed, we're going to find something else to do. And so I think it's really important when you start new people to give them a gun that doesn't kick, a gun that fits them. You know, if the stock is too long or too awkward, it makes it hard to hold the gun, and then they do suffer more from recoil that way too. But you have to be very mindful of that and keep it down to, when I shot with my kids, we would shoot, 30, 40 shots is usually enough time to call in before they started to get a little fatigued and couldn't hit as well. And so dole it out in little doses, and keep it fun, keep it from hurting, and they'll be back for more. You know, and quit while you're having fun, too, so they won't come again.
Exactly. You know, it's just like any other form of teaching and learning. You want them wanting more, not wanting less, and that's one good way to do it. You know, I might add to that what I've done when I've what little qualification I have for it is I'll start beginners out with a stationary target. I mean, if they've never picked up a gun before and it's their first experience, we'll put a clay target on a hay bale, and so the first shot is a successful shot. Unless I'm shooting, then I'll miss. But just that immediate gratification, that's what they get out of everything else they're doing as kids. We've got to compete against video games, YouTube, and Instagram. It's called Instagram for a reason, you know? So, Phil, we're getting down to it here. I would love to talk with you more about a favorite place, and I don't mean a latitude and longitude, because if you told me that, you'd have to kill me. But if you had to go one place, and it doesn't need to be a geographic location, it could be a place, you know, a type of place you like to go to, where would you go?
I'd go back to the early days of CRP in right where I live, back when fields of broom grass, and they get to be terrible habitat after a while, but when they're new, they're great, and they're like mid-shin height, and you can see everything, and they were fields, back in the 90s, those fields were full of birds, and really, I don't think upland hunting gets a whole lot better than that. I love those times, and we still got enough birds to chase, but not like that. So, I hate to say that, because it's kind of not coming back. I don't think we're going to see that again for a while. But that was my favorite, that kind of pheasant hunting. And there's a couple places like that where I hunt today where you can see the dog. You know, I'm walking through grass that's up to the middle of your chest. There's a lot of birds in it, but you don't get to watch your dogs, which is kind of why I go.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago, snowy field of switchgrass, stepping on my first German short hair with both feet. He was on point. I was looking for him, and I couldn't see a thing, and I looked down, and I was actually standing on him with both feet, and he was looking at me like, why are you standing on me? There's a bird right here.
I'm going to share a similar story in a couple minutes.
So I guess that's, I like that a lot. As I grew up hunting pheasants, I do like quail hunting a lot. I'm getting to like that more and more, if only because I really like the taste of quail, and it's fun. And we've had more quail around here these last few years, so I've gotten kind of more of a taste for it.
Well, in a lot of ways, I'm like you. I was country before country was cool. You know, remember that? You were a locavore before they had invented the word. And you just said it again. You said, do you like quail because it tastes so good? Give us one quail preparation for cooking or quail care tip that will help our quail taste as good as Phil Bourgeli's quail.
I'm a plucker.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people aren't. And, you know, I can see with a pheasant or, and I do draw the line, I won't pluck a whole Canada goose anymore because that's like a 2-hour project, but I'll take the feathers off the breast and the legs. But with a quail, it takes 5 minutes to pluck a bird. So what I really like to do with a quail is pluck it, and then split it up the back and flatten it out and throw it under the broiler or on a grill for just a few minutes. And that way you've got that skin to keep the meat moist.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I guess if I was offering a tip to, for cooking birds, I'd take the time to pluck birds. I pluck pheasants still. I can do a pheasant they're harder. I can do one in about 20 minutes. And I've eaten a lot of roast pheasant over the years. And that's still my favorite. Roast them whole. So yeah, that's, and a lot of people, because it's easier, because that's how they've been taught, just want to skin their birds, and I think there's quite a bit of value to leaving the skin on.
No, I can testify to that. You're a plucker, I'm a Presbyterian, but other people may want to do it another way, and I share your pain. I plucked 4 Canada geese one night, and the problem with that is both hands are busy the whole time. It's hard to reach for that beer can.
Yes, and then there's the cleanup after that. It's just a chore.
You do it at somebody else's house.
I did in the garage. My wife used to let me do it in the kitchen. This is one of the reasons we've been married for 35 years. She would let me pluck a goose, because it's cold in the garage. So she let me bring them in and pluck them in the house, which a lot of people wouldn't put up with that.
Yep.
But I say, now I'll take the skin off the breast. I'll take the skin off the legs and thighs and keep those. And I don't keep the carcass anymore. There's not enough of us at home to roast the whole goose anyway. So that's how I do it.
I love
it. Yeah, it's a chore.
Yeah, it is. And by the way, you may be a plucker, but you're also a spatchcocker. Did you know that?
I just learned that recently. I've heard that about myself. yeah, I am.
That's when you split that bird up the middle along the back and then lay him flat like that. So
right.
Kids, you can try that at home. In fact, if you did some of that for your parents, maybe you'd get invited on more hunting trips. Well, Phil, you know, we could go on forever and ever. And as next time we have this conversation, maybe it'll be in an Iowa pheasant field because, you know, meeting in Las Vegas is fine, but I'd rather be hunting, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. And hunting season now runs right up the day before I leave for SHOT Show. So it works out just fine. But yeah, I would rather be hunting than be there too.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you there next, if not before. It's always good to talk with you. Phil Bergeli with Field & Stream Magazine, among other things. Friend of mine, shotgunning expert, and kind enough to spend a little bit of time with all of us here at the Upland Nation. I'm Scott Linden. Stick around, everybody except Phil. I'm going to turn you off right now. Thank you again, Phil. It was great talking with you.
Thank you very much, Scott.
And we are back talking about our other sponsor, which is my product, the dogenergybar.com. If you're looking for a pick-me-up for your dog in the field that actually will keep his belly and his gastrointestinal tract from malfunctioning by overburdening it with other food, take a look at dogenergybar.com. Learn more about the nutrition that goes into fueling your dog for the field that day in the hunt. dogenergybar.com. Thank you for listening. I appreciate that a lot. And here we come with, you know, some more public access information. I call this little segment, This Land Is Your Land, for a reason. And Phil was talking about, hey, that tells me I'm on time. Phil tells me, you know, about his stepping on dog story. Well, I have one for you too. And it was wonderful because it was near Watertown, South Dakota. Now, South Dakota is probably the gold standard when it comes to public access on private ground. They have a great system, and now they have an app that helps even more. If you wanted to head for Watertown, you could basically stay anywhere near or in town. pick up the book or get the app and find a spot on the map. There's various colors of tracts. The blue ones are the ones I like the most because they're smaller and they're usually waterfowl production areas of one sort or another. So the pheasant hunters are going somewhere else. The joy of that is there are still pheasants. So find the blue spots or find the other small, dark-colored green and brown or something like that. I'm colorblind, so I have a hard time with that. Find the little spots. Hunt them, and you may find pheasants. I was in a cattail slough a couple years ago with my old guy Manny, and I couldn't find him. But my GPS told me he was right there. And sure enough, I was not standing on him like Phil was, but it was just as bad because I was standing right next to him. He was on point on a porcupine. Everything turned out okay. It was pretty noisy, but the porcupine went away unscathed. So did Manny, and luckily, so did I. We left that spot, but there are plenty more just like that. There are small spots of all sorts all over South Dakota. Watertown may as well be in Minnesota for all the water they have up there, hence the name. But that's kind of the cool part, because all around those water holes and lakes and small ponds is pheasant habitat. Check it out. That land is your land too. So next time you're in the neighborhood, get yourself the atlas and enjoy yourself near Watertown, South Dakota. Well, you know, we got one more thing to cover with you. I promised a question and a winner for our trivia question. Last week's question was, what is the English name for the bird that's Latin name is Bonassa umbellus? I don't know a lot of Latin, but I'll bet umbellus has something to do with drumming. Duh. Congratulations, TJ Downs. You're winning that Joe Beef cookbook for naming Bonassa umbellus as the ruffed grouse. This week's question, now's your chance. Go to scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com with your answer. What year was South Dakota's first pheasant hunting season? You'll win a season's worth of my dog energy bar. What year was South Dakota's first pheasant hunting season? Good luck. I hope I'll talk with you at scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com or at uplandnation.com or the Facebook page of the same name. Appreciate your listening. Hope you're enjoying the Upland Nation podcast. I hope you'll check out my television show, Wing Shooting USA. And I hope you'll tell your friends to do all of the same things. You're very kind to pay attention as long as you do. I appreciate it. Have a great day in the field.